Today's Taisho will be on Case 10 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 10 is entitled, Seizei is Utterly Destitute. Seizei said to Sōsan, Seizei is utterly destitute. Will you give him some support? Sōsan called out, Seizei. Seizei responded, Yes, sir. Sōsan said, You have finished 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and still you say you haven't moistened your lips. Mumon's comment, Seizei pretended to retreat. What was his scheme? Sōsan had the eye of Buddha and saw through his opponent's motive. However, I want to ask you, at what point did Seizei drink wine? Mumon's verse, Poverty like Hantan's, mind like Ku's, with no means of livelihood, he dares to rival the richest. So I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning. It's probably beautiful out there, beautiful day. And some of you may be going to Rutgers Day celebrations, and who knows what will happen. This koan is really, I think, a very important koan. And it's easy to overlook it in the collection of koans, maybe because it's so simple. But there is something really elemental about this koan. We all have this feeling or this fear of being utterly destitute. Utterly destitute doesn't just mean no money, you know. Last week I went to Philadelphia to see Van Gogh's wonderful paintings at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And I have to tell you, I haven't always been like a big fan of Van Gogh. When I was in college, there were so many people in my dormitory who had posters on their walls of Van Gogh's Sunflowers or Starry Night, and it just never spoke to me. But I went to this show, and it was really quite powerful. It ends very soon, and I recommend it to you highly. It's really quite a wonderful, wonderful show. I think you've got another month, basically, to see it. Room after room of magnificent paintings. And I have studied Van Gogh's paintings all my life, but seeing them was really very powerful. And toward the end of the show, I learned that Van Gogh had never sold a painting while he was alive. He never sold a single painting. And these are paintings today that hundreds of thousands of people come to see every year. And that when I went to see it at the museum, they had carefully limited the number of people who could go in to the exhibit at one time. But all the same, everybody was crowding around the paintings. And in his lifetime, he couldn't give them away. And I thought that was really poignant, because here was somebody who really, really wanted to paint. And And it turns out Van Gogh had this very deep knowledge of art history. People said originally that he was a sort of self-taught natural artist who worked from basically inspiration. But since then, they have discovered his notebooks, and his notebooks are full of references to great classics of Renaissance art and French art. And it shows, the notebooks show that Van Gogh had this deep, deep knowledge, and that he studied art all the time, and his own painting was informed by this deep knowledge that he had of painting and art history. And so, you know, it was clear to me that Van Gogh was somebody who trained all his life to be a painter. It was his aspiration, his dream, and his fantasy. And he did these paintings over a very brief lifetime. I did not realize that he died at 37. So he was this tremendously prolific painter. Many of the paintings that I looked at in one room were all painted in 1890. He must have just been painting furiously the whole year. And painting after painting is very fresh, very alive, but he couldn't give them away. And I thought about how difficult that must have been for him. You know, Van Gogh had a dream or a fantasy, right? His dream, his fantasy was that he was going to paint these pictures and people would look at them and say, "Oh my God, Vincent, you know, those are fantastic pictures." And they would say, you're such a great painter. I must have that painting at any price, you know. And instead, he did these paintings. He had a lot of problems psychologically. Some of his greatest paintings were done while he was a patient in a mental hospital. And so he had to contend with maybe something like bipolar disorder. At the same time, he had to contend with like the disappointment or a constant sense of failure, you know. And these paintings are so beautiful. It's perhaps possible to say you can see in the paintings some of his pain, you know. But when I was at the show, I was just so struck by how courageously he kept painting, even though his dreams didn't get fulfilled. And it occurred to me, you know, at the time, you know, we all have these fantasies, right? We all have these fantasies, these dreams, or you could say desires, basically. You know, I remember a friend of mine in school. He wanted to be a doctor. And he, his parents didn't have much money. And he, I remember he used to, well, he was down the hall from me. And his name was Saul. And he was a really nice guy. We used to spend a lot of free time together. We didn't have that much free time because we were both working very hard in school. But, you know, we'd hang together. And he had very little money, like me. I didn't have much money either. And, you know, in our second year of school, we both had like hot plates in our rooms, and because that was cheaper than having a meal plan at the cafeteria. And we were both eating like canned tuna fish and tuna helper, you know, out of a pot, the one pot we each owned, that sort of thing. And he wanted to be a doctor, and so badly. And years later, I heard from one of my friends that he got out of medicine. He actually became a doctor and he went into research because it wasn't what he wanted. And I thought that was so interesting because when I met him, he had this burning desire, this powerful desire to be a doctor. You know, I was reading this essay by this man named Daniel Gilbert, who's a psychologist. And he said that people are very bad at predicting what will make them happy. He's a social scientist, so he has to make a term for it. He calls it affective forecasting. But he says humans are notoriously terrible at affective forecasting. If you ask somebody, what would make you happy? And they tell you, and then you track them, you know, 5 years later, very often they've gotten what they thought would make them happy, but it hasn't made them happy. And he said, people are notoriously bad at predicting what's going to make them happy. On the other hand, things that make us happy are also often totally unanticipated, totally unexpected. So, you know, my friend Saul wanted to be a doctor, and I think he had many fantasies about being a doctor. I imagine, you know, he would see, you know, in his mind he was going to, you know, he didn't really know what it was like to be a doctor, but he must have had fantasies, you know. I'll go to my office, I'll have a nice office, it'll say Dr. Saul Shapiro on the door. You know, the patients will come in, they'll all be very nice people. You know, he'll diagnose their illnesses and prescribe medicines. Oh, thank you, doctor, you know. It'll be like medical show on TV, you know. How you've saved my life, thank you, you know. And then, you know, so that's how he imagined it. Now, I actually have a very good internist who is my primary care physician. And I have paid a lot of attention to his life, you know, because he had cancer a few years ago, and he made it through. But I think he has a very challenging life. You know, he has two offices. He has an office in Plainfield and an office in Edison. And I think he starts at, you know, very early in the morning seeing patients, and he goes till late at night, and he must do 2.5 days or, you know, 3 days in Edison and 2.5 days or 3 days in Plainfield. And I think his life is very difficult. I think it's difficult to be a general primary care physician, you know, because when I go into that waiting room, it's filled with people who are sick, right? And a lot of them are quite old, and they're, you know, they can't always get out of the chair easily, and, you know, so his day, I think, is often filled with dealing with old, sick people all day long, you know, for long hours. And when he got cancer, I was really worried about him. I thought he might not make it. He went through chemo, he lost all his hair. And one time, I've been his patient for many years, but we were having a session. He was giving me, you know, my yearly physical. And he said, "So, are you a professor at Rutgers?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm a professor." And he said, "That must be a nice job." Yeah. And he said, "You know," "something about, you know, retirement or something." And I think I'm not sure he can retire. You know, I think he was thinking, oh boy, you know, you work for the state of New Jersey, you know, you just show up for work and you get a paycheck. And he didn't say any of this, but I could see there was a kind of like, oh, I wish I were living your life. You know, there was slightly like that, you know. And, you know, I think he might have had regrets, actually, that he became a doctor, you know, I work with people who are professors, you know, and you know, when they started out their lives, they thought something very differently, probably, about how things were going to turn out. You know, you think a professor, you know, ideas, you know, you go to your office and you think, you read, you know, big books and you think hard and you write. you go into your class and you lecture, and all the students are admiring you, thinking, what a mind, reality is very different, You go in and half of your students are reading the Targum, you've worked on this stuff for 20 years, and they really couldn't care less, it's just a credit to them, and so on, and your colleagues are all grouchy, and, you write something and people try to shoot it down, and, you start, you think, professor, a doctor, and there's the fantasy and the desire. This koan is really about this, about fantasy and desire. We form an image of how things are going to be, and we want to make that real, and we pursue it. And it might be something we pursue for a couple of weeks, or it might be something we pursue for a lifetime. If you think about it, humans are like fantasy machines or desiring machines. We fantasize about what could be or what should be. And it's often very compelling, very powerful. And desire is like this too, right? We desire pretty much what we don't have, right? You don't really desire what you have. I mean, that's obvious in a way. You desire what you don't have. If you go home and there's a bowl of apples on the table in the kitchen, that's great. You look, I'll have an apple. You come home the next day, I'll have an apple. After a while you think, oh, I'm sick of these damn apples, I'd like a pear. A pear. But there's no pears around, right? And so that now the pear becomes very important. It's like this is, you desire what you can't have, right? And what you have, you don't desire. And this is tied in with, the fantasy machine, right? This is so human. So, my friend Saul, his parents had a small, a mom-and-pop grocery store. And, they were immigrants to the United States. And, for them, I'm sure, being a doctor meant you don't have to worry about, money. People respect you. They need, that sort of thing. The reality being, so my friend pursued this and he became a doctor, and at some point he must have realized, oh man, this is not what I thought, right? And this is so human, right? This is, we create these fantasies and we pursue them, and there's this powerful desiring machine in operation, right? When I first met my wife, it wasn't like love at first sight. We've been married for 34 years. But it wasn't love at first sight, but my wife was very attractive, really attractive. And we would flirt. I was working as a cook in a restaurant. I had hitchhiked out to Albuquerque, New Mexico to spend the summer backpacking, and I needed to make some money, so I was working in an Italian restaurant called Mama Mia's Restaurant. And I would get there at 8 in the morning. It was a long, 8 to 11 with a little break in the afternoon. And my wife was a student at the UNM, at University of New Mexico. And we would flirt, but at some point, my wife became an object of my desire, right? And she became this magical person for me, So, I would go home from the restaurant and think about Barbara. Barbara, I'd go to the store and think, oh, if only Barbara were here, what would she buy, and I'd imagine what she'd buy, and I'd wake up in the morning thinking, Barbara, Barbara, Barbara. And this is very human, right? This is what it means to fall in love, right? And and you know, I would sometimes, you know, we went out on a date, you know, like we went out on a date, and you know, little by little, this began to snowball, right? So that, and when I was with her, everything she did was like fascinating and very exciting and mysterious, you know. And it would be just, this was so amazing to me, right? It would be, you know, there was, I just couldn't, I still can't describe it, but it was like everything she did was imbued with this special liveliness, and this is what it means to be in love. She was like an object of my desire, you know? And I had this idea that if I could just, you know, be with her, you know, like once and for all, life would be like totally happy and fulfilling. This is like a standard human dream, right? It's like, this is like wanting to be, oh, you're in the wrong place. This is like wanting to be a doctor, right? You think, oh, when I get to be a doctor, right now, there's a lot of problems in my life, but when I get to be a doctor, I'll be done, you know? It'll be complete. You know, my relationship was like this with my wife. Everything she did was magical. There's a song by Sting, by the Police. Everything she does is really magic. You know, this is love, right? So if you flash forward 25 years, yeah? Those of you who haven't been married 25 years, I'm not trying to disillusion you. But it was a different relationship. Every word that came out of her mouth was not magic anymore. Right? It's like I could finish her sentences for her, yes? And not always like in a good way, right? You can see who's been through this. This, you know, now things have changed, right? So what I'm not saying is that you shouldn't become a doctor or whatever you want to be, or I'm not saying you shouldn't fall in love. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that you should observe this phenomenon, you should observe the mechanics or the process of fantasy and desire, and then what happens. You know, the old saying is wanting is better than having. There's something about this process of creating creating an object of desire, and then you get what you desire, and you find that little by little, the energy drains away. You know, the energy drains away. And then, you know, that can be very disillusioning. So my friend Saul quit medicine, actually, or he went into research medicine, because he must have just realized, I don't want to see another patient for the rest of my life. I just want to go into a lab, and what I really liked anyway was the science, right? And you know, people go through crises in their relationship because you marry somebody, and what you're really marrying is, you know, as many people will tell you, you're marrying your ego ideal, you know. You're marrying this person who you think will fulfill all these unfulfilled parts of yourself, right? You know, basically, this is well known, you know. You didn't get certain things from growing up, from your family, and then you're looking for those things in your partner. And it has a real urgency, because this is like something that's built up over a whole lifetime. And at first, you know, you're married to this magical person, but then you realize, wait a minute, this is not the person I imagine. You know, you begin to peel away all these layers of fantasy, and you begin to encounter somebody who has her own existence or his own existence. Now, this is incredibly human. We do this all the time. You know, in fact, you know, it's very, very, very difficult for human beings to be in the real world at all. You know, the average person thinks that he or she is in reality pretty much all the time. And the problem is that reality is boring, right? You know, so you go to your job every day. It's always the same job. You know, you're either tense or frightened or you're bored, right? This is, and you think, well, this is reality. It's just here. It's obvious. But it's not like that at all, you know. It's very, very difficult for humans to be in the moment, in the real world. It's very difficult. We almost never do it. Humans are like an oyster. You know, when something annoys us or frightens us or troubles us, we secrete dreams around it, right? We secrete fantasy. We're an oyster that secretes fantasy. And so, you know, we're constantly secreting fantasies. And we move from fantasy to fantasy. Not just on the big level, you know, in our life, but from moment to moment. We're constantly fantasizing. And desire is making us sort of walk away from what we have towards what we don't have. This is like a mechanism that's going all the time, almost 24 hours a day, you know. And yet, you know, having is such an interesting thing because when you have, it can be very desiring. Wanting is one thing. Having is quite another experience. What often happens in having is that you find that the thing you desired becomes valueless, right? Empty, lifeless. You know, so much of our lives are like that. You know, you want to be a doctor, you get the diploma, you get the handshake, you do your brutal, period as a resident. Then you have a white coat. You know, you have a bag. I don't know if doctors carry a bag anymore, but you get the doctor's bag. You have the MD on your card. And then you go into your office for 25 years, and you, after a while, you know, you think, "Is this is what it means to be a doctor?" You know, it's like the meaning drains away, and this happens to us on a micro level all the time. So you know, you think, "Boy, I would love a beer." You know, you're mowing the lawn; it's hot. You think a beer, that would be perfect. You know, probably. Before you get through the can of beer, it's already lost it, you know? I mean, maybe not. Maybe every sip is fresh, but it's probably not the case. It's probably the case that you have the first sip and you think, beer, how good. Next sip, it's okay. Next sip, it's just a sip, right? After a while, you know, it's like the taste, the liveliness of the experience goes away. And then you start thinking about something else. You start desiring something else. Like, maybe I should have a sandwich with this beer. You know? Then you get the sandwich. The first, cheese sandwich. I haven't had one of these. A BLT, right? You know? Oh my gosh, you know? And then you taste, that next bite, less. It's like, first bite, you know, 100%. Second bite, 70%. Third bite, 40%. And so on, you know? After a while, it doesn't taste. It doesn't have any taste. You know, this is how, you know, people can eat like a bag of candy, like a whole bag of candy. You know, every candy doesn't taste like candy, right? The first one tastes like candy, you know. You have the first Hershey's Kiss and you think, chocolate, you know, how amazing. You know, by the time you're at the seventh kiss, you know, it's just a reflex, right? In fact, it's neurotic, right? At that point, you're trying to recapture the chocolate feeling, but it's gone. And you keep eating because you can't get back there, right? Does that sound true? This is fascinating, I think, you know, how we desire what we don't have, and then when we have it, it's like the energy or the life drains away. And this creates all kinds of problems for us as people. Because it's very difficult to encounter the thing in itself, the person in itself, right? Without all of these projections and all of this desiring machine operating, right? And there's a downside to this too, because you know, so often life doesn't. It's not just that the meaning drains away or the flavor drains away. By the time you've eaten your fifth Hershey's Kiss, there's nothing left. There's no chocolateness left, right? But it's even more of a difficulty than that, because you know, so often life just totally fails to match our expectations, you know. I remember when I was in college, I went to the University of Virginia, and at that time, there were a lot of people there had a lot of money. It's not usually an Ivy League school, but it was filled with rich people, and I had almost zero money, you know, and I hung out with my friend Saul. And he had zero money, and that was one of the things we would commiserate with each other about. But I remember there was this girl in my class whose name was Carol. And I was taking anthropology classes, and she was in some of my anthropology classes. And she was beautiful. She was a hippie princess, you know. So she used to wear a long peasant skirt and a peasant blouse, and she would come to class, and she always was smiling. I wasn't smiling inside, you know, and I would look at her, and she was always smiling, and I just thought, oh, not only is she beautiful, but she's happy all the time. And I would see her in class, and she was intelligent and articulate, and I would just think, oh, you know, I would love it if I could, you know, somehow strike up a relationship with this marvelous person. So I was pretty shy. So it took me a long time to get up the nerve to go up to her. And I remember, even now, like this is what, 40 years later, something like that. Not quite, but it's getting there. I went up to her and I had sort of rehearsed. I would tell her this joke, you know, based on we were reading. You know, Malinowski, this anthropologist, and I would you know, it was about kinship or something, and I would tell her this joke, and you know, basically in my mind it would work like this. I'd come up, you know, sort of casually, like I didn't intend to come up and say hello, you know, like I just ran into her, and I'd rehearsed it all. I'd tell the joke, we'd laugh, you know, and then for a minute, you know, there'd be a rapport. Then I might say, hey, do you want to get a cup of coffee? You know, and I remember, you know, I it started out okay, you know, and then I told the joke and she didn't laugh. Right? It was devastating, right? It's like, you know, and then I finally did on a later occasion, I actually did, actually get up the nerve to ask. We were studying together, actually. We were in the same room at the library, and we were studying for our anthropology test, and I said, you know, oh boy, this is going to be a tough test, yeah. And then I said, hey, you know, would you like to go out with me? And she said something like, it was so nice, she just said, you know, I'm really trying to, you know, get away from that. You know, basically she'd been in a lot of relationships, and she said some of them she didn't think were so healthy, and she just wanted to have some space to be herself, you know, and she said, you seem like a nice guy, and it was a nice rejection, you know, and about 3 weeks later, I saw her with some very cool-looking dude, you know, with sunglasses, and he looked like a movie star, you know, so maybe she was over her period of being alone, you know, voluntary solitude. But if she did it gently, you know. But the thing is, when my joke didn't work and so on, I remember that. It's just I felt tremendously uneasy, right? Because reality wasn't unfolding the way I wanted. You know, I had a fantasy, and then reality wasn't following my fantasy, and then there was this tremendous sense of anxiety and you know, my own sense of paralysis, and you know. I'll never have a relationship with another human being. No woman will ever want to talk to me in life, you know. So I mean, I had at the bottom of my mind somewhere, there's terror, right? You know, that everybody else I knew would have a relationship, but I would be 90 years old in my room, you know, sitting there by myself, and so on. So humans are very curious creatures, right? It's very hard for us not to be caught up in this dynamic, you know. And Zen too, you know, actually involves a great deal of fantasy, you know. So we come in and we sit down on the cushion and we're told, watch your breath, right? You're supposed to watch your breath, but, you know, you watch the first breath, you watch the second breath, and then the fantasy, you know, slash desiring machine starts rolling on, you know, and you're thinking, you know, what about that, you know, maybe you're thinking, what about that girl in anthropology class, you know? She's very beautiful. Or you're thinking, you know, if I talk to my boss, he'll give me a raise. I just have to go in and say it, right? You know, Jim, I deserve more money, you know, and this kind of thing. Or you know, you're having anxieties, and you're imagining your worst case. You know, the fantasy desiring machine is on right away, right? And maybe you come to sit, and you're having a fantasy about sitting, you know, and you're thinking, I'm going to sit down on the cushion. You know, people come to Sesshin, you know, with these first couple of Sesshin, people come to Sesshin thinking, I'm going to have an enlightenment experience. You know, I'm going to come here, I'm going to sit. You know, by the third day, you know, something's going to happen. I'll go in to see the teacher and he'll go, my God, you've done it, you know. you're there. And, you know, it's quite deflating, right? When you come to a couple sesshins and you realize that, you know, whatever enlightenment is, it's not going to happen today, right? Probably, you know. It may take a long time, a lot of work, and you know. So part of the dynamic of Zen practice is coming to the cushion with the desiring fantasy machine operating. And you keep coming back to the breath, back to the breath, back to the breath, and all kinds of things can happen on the cushion. You know, you can get very upset. You know, you can. What am I doing here? You know, this is a waste of my time. I could be in my car right now, driving up to North Jersey. I would be happy there in my car. You know, if only I were there, everything would be okay, right? You know, or you're thinking, I'll never get anywhere with this, you know, and this, all of these fantasies, you know, cross through your mind. You keep coming back to the breath, and you know, the bell rings and you go to the bathroom, and you feel the, you know, cold tiles on your feet. And maybe it feels refreshing for a moment, you know, and then you take a pee and you realize, you know, this is wonderful. Really, I mean, few things are more wonderful, actually, than having to take a pee and then taking a pee, you know. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. You know, you wash your hands, maybe you lean over and you have a drink of water. When we sit here in the evening, you know, people come from a busy day, they sit down on the cushion, they sort of decompress. You know exactly what's coming. At the end of the evening, there's going to be tea. And it's the same tea every night, same date. And, you know, on Wednesday night, you know, we had tea. The same tea, same date for years, right? I ate that date, and it was so delicious. It was just delicious. And the tea was just amazing, you know. I mean, we get good tea, but it was like, you know, ambrosia. This is so good. This tea is so good. What I would say is that we're having an experience of the tea or of the date, which is, you know, it's not any longer part of the fantasy, right? We've sort of like cleared away the fantasy, and we're just experiencing the tea, we're just experiencing the date. And it's so alive, right? So wonderful. It's just absolutely delicious. This I think is very special. This ability to peel away these layers of fantasy and just be present in the moment. And it's a challenge because we're terrified of that. We're terrified of having no object of desire, or having. Sometimes you get what you want, and you realize it's not what you really want, and then you discover that it's remarkable anyway, right? This happens all the time, you know. So you think, I'm going to go to Colorado and hike with my old friend Bill, and you go to Colorado, and nothing turns out the way you planned, right? Nothing turns out the way you expected. But all the same, it can be a wonderful experience. And not what you wanted, but what you have, And Zen is really all about discovering the power of that situation. It's not what you wanted, but it's what you have. We have a fantasy about how things are supposed to go. And if we get our fantasy fulfilled, the meaning drains away. And we're left with kind of an empty shell of our dream, right? And if we don't get our fantasy, same thing. It's possible to wind up living in a world that's like very empty, very lifeless. But Zen is, all about discovering what the world can be like after our dreams are gone. Like, after our dreams are gone, this is not what I wanted, right? This is not what I wanted. Okay, fine. Now what? See, and when something is no longer imbued with desire, and it's no longer imbued with fantasy, at first that can seem quite dead and quite the worst possible thing that can happen. But then you discover, actually that it's really quite remarkable just to be in this moment. Yeah. You could say that Zen is like a constant. This sounds a little, I wrote this book a few years ago, and I said that Zen was like waiting for a train that never arrives. I actually wrote that. I said you go to the you're going to the train station, or you go to Newark Airport, right? It's supposed to take you to Paris, and you're thinking, boy, when I get to Paris, everything will be perfect. Right now, my life is not perfect, but when I get to Paris, it's going to be great. And so this is your fantasy. This is the object of your desire, right? And so you go to the airport, and you're full of anticipation, and you get to Paris, and then everybody's rude to you, and you think, why did I come to Paris? But let's say you don't get that far. You just go to the airport, you sit in Newark Airport, and you're waiting for the plane, but the plane is delayed an hour, it's delayed 2 hours, it's delayed 3 hours, it's delayed a day, it's delayed, 20 days. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do in the meanwhile? So anyway, I in my book I said Zen is like waiting for a train that never arrives, right? And the editor hated this. He made me take it out of the book. He said, we're not going to sell any books on Zen if you say that. Really? He made me take it out. He crossed it out, and I put it back in, and he crossed it out again. It's like, well, you're not going to sell any books if you say this, right? But all the same, I was on to something. You're waiting for the train. The train's going to take you to the place you really want to go, right? But meanwhile, you're at this place that's nowhere, the train station, right? And it's not the object of your desire, but then you discover, you know, this is really a wonderful place to be. You know, it's really a wonderful place to be. I think this is the essence of Zen, right? You know, we imbue things with our desire, and whether we achieve them or not, the desire, you know, the energy drains away, and we're left with an empty object. It's like it's always too late, you know, over. We get it and it's over, or we don't get it, and it's the same thing. So the train comes or it doesn't come. It's the same situation. You know, you're stuck at the train station waiting for a train that never arrives. And that sounds like an incredibly undesirable situation until it happens to you, right? And it happens on the cushion all the time, right? And you realize, this isn't where I want it to be, you know. But this is really a wonderful place to be. When I got out of college, I had no car. I went to this school where everybody was really wealthy. And as graduation presents, parents would give their kids a car, you know. My father gave me a box of underwear. Really? So here's your graduation present. I thought, what is it? I opened it up and it was a box full of like undershirt, t-shirts and, you know, skivvies, you know. And he said, a man can always use more underwear. I said, thanks, Dad. So anyway, I wanted to, you know, and other parents sent their kids to Europe, you know, it was like, and I was like, now I have to go get a job, right, you know, with my new underwear. So I didn't want to just get a job, I wanted to do something exciting, so I decided to travel, and my friend Larry Sullivan and I agreed to meet in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then we were going to hike in the Rockies, in the Southern Rockies, which we did, and it was wonderful. But I didn't have any money, so the way I got across the country was hitchhiking. You know, this is not something you can probably do anymore, but you go out, you would get to the entry to the interstate highway with my backpack, you know, and I would just stick out my thumb. And sooner or later, somebody would pick me up and take me like 300 miles and dump me off, and then I would get on another ramp to the interstate and sit there with my thumb out. And somebody would pick me up and take me 800 miles, you know. And I actually got across the entire United States that way many times, you know. And it's the most amazing thing, right? Because you come out to the highway and you think, okay, I'm going to get a ride. I feel lucky today, you know. You stick your thumb out and it's like, come on, you know, nothing. Or car drives by. And after a while you think, I'm never going to get a ride, you know. But then, you know, sooner or later somebody picks you up and they might be taking you 50 miles or they might be taking you 800 miles. And you're standing there waiting for something to happen and nothing is happening. And, you know, again, it's that thing, you could be agonized by this if you're, you know, a type A personality, you sit there and you think, I've got to, you know, why didn't I just take the bus? You know, why didn't, you know? And then you're sitting there and you're waiting for something to happen. In the meantime, you notice, you know, that there's a hawk circling overhead, or there's a blue jay picking, you know, something up off the ground, or you notice the beautiful trees, or you begin to be connected to the world around you in a different way. It's not colored by your desires, you know. The fantasy, it's not the fantasy. It's what you didn't want or you didn't expect. And you realize this is really quite wonderful. I think these moments are where we begin to get in touch with reality, right? It's where it's the reality moment, you know. It's like we bump up against a world that we usually surround with all these fantasies. And hitchhiking is like a Zen practice, right? You can't predict where you're going. You know, you know you're going to California, but that's about it. You can't predict if you're going to go 300 miles or 30 miles. You know, and you can get into the car with the nicest people in the world. I would get in, and these people were just wonderful. You know, this was 1975. So I'd get in the car, and somebody would say, "Hey, do you want to smoke a joint?" You know, "Sure." Okay, and they, "Hey, let's go get some lunch." You know, and they, "No, I'll buy it." You know, I didn't have much money anyway. So it was like, "How wonderful you're going to give me lunch too?" You know, and people would say, "You want to stay at my house?" You know, and I would stay at people's houses and meet their families, and you know, it was wonderful. And sometimes I would meet people who were creeps, you know, very weird and menacing, you know. Yeah. So you never know, right? But I would sometimes feel so alive out there by the road, you know, sitting waiting for something to happen. And it wasn't my fantasy. You know, if you said, "Did you fantasize about sitting by a road for 8 hours?" No. That my fantasy was I would be there for 15 minutes and, you know, some beautiful woman would pick me up and take me to California and we would get married and, you know, I would work for her father, Donald Trump, you know. But that never happened. What did happen was actually quite magical. And this is very much what happens on the cushion, right? You know, we keep coming back to the moment. You know, our fantasy machine, the desiring machine, is producing all of this stuff, and we keep coming back to the moment, which seems so uninteresting for such a long time, and so valueless. And then, you know, sometimes you just discover the moment is really this amazing. Reality is really quite amazing. There's like a little glimpse of reality. Seize said to Sozan, "Seize is utterly destitute. Will you give him support?" You know, it's like, my dreams, you know, what if my dreams don't come true? What if my dreams don't come true, you know? Sozan called out, "Seize!" Seize responded, "Yes, sir." Sozan said, "You have finished 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and yet you still say that you haven't even moistened your lips." Mumon's comment. Seize pretended to retreat. What was his scheme? Sozan had the eye of Buddha and saw through his opponent's motive. However, I want to ask you, at what point did Seize drink the wine? Mumon's verse. Poverty like Han Tan's, mind like Ku's. With no means of livelihood, he dares to rival the richest.